I'm Gene Kansas. You're listening to Sidewalk Radio. We cover the arts, architecture, design, development, city planning, preservation. Today's show, Freedom, the City from Civil War to Civil Rights.
Identity is a question about Atlanta. You know, we seem to think that because everything is torn down and built anew, that there is no Atlanta identity. Well, I would argue that that is the Atlanta identity. And I think furthermore that there are some features, historical features of an Atlanta identity that we have, but we don't really know and don't really celebrate because they're sort of mixed blessings. And particularly the Civil War is one of those. And I think that Atlanta's identity really needs to be rooted in this notion of Civil War to civil rights. What other southern city can say that? What other southern city was the last turning point in the Civil War and the birthplace of the civil rights movement? Name one. There isn't any. It's Atlanta. That's part of our identity, if not all of it.
My guests today are Gordon Jones, senior military historian at the Atlanta History Center, U.S. Congressman John Lewis, a civil rights icon, Doug Shipman, CEO of the National Center for Civil and Human Rights, and board chairman of the Wren's Nest, Lane Shakespeare, the great-great-great-grandson of author Joel Chandler Harris. It is poetic to think of ourselves as a nation founded on the mutual ideals of freedom and equality. But as a city, Atlanta, more than any other city in the country, has its foundations, both cultural and physical, shaped by the struggle for freedom. For today's show, we'll be examining how this abstract concept was quite literally made into concrete. But let's begin with some historical perspective. What role did the Civil War play in Atlanta becoming a civil rights capital?
A big role. In as much that Atlanta was really the last great turning point of the Civil War. Let's go back to 1864. Lincoln is up for re-election. The war at this point had been long and bloody, and even though you had the, you know, supposed victory at Gettysburg, it was still going to be a long road to defeat the Confederacy. There was a lot of political opposition in the North to Lincoln's twin goals of restoring the Union and emancipation, but especially to emancipation. And there was a faction of the Democratic Party, the Peace Democrats, who were opposed to Lincoln's continuation of the war. They advocated a restored Union on the basis of a negotiated peace with the Confederacy. They favored essentially ending the war, calling it quits, right? So on the battlefield, Lincoln's armies need to show that they can win the war. They need to show a war-weary Northern public that a victory is possible and that those twin goals can be achieved. Atlanta is that victory. Grant fails to get the victory in Richmond. Sherman manages by the skin of his teeth to get the victory here in Atlanta. That's the thing that really tips the scales. It devastates white Southern morale. It's a great boost to Northern morale. Lincoln ends up winning re-election. Without winning re-election, we may have had a negotiated peace with the Confederacy. So Atlanta is the last great turning point of the Civil War.
I understand that, and it's interesting the play of politics in that, but Atlanta as a city, I mean, why isn't the civil rights capital of the world in Washington, or why Atlanta?
Right. Well, one big reason why Atlanta becomes the civil rights capital is because of what happened immediately after the war in the founding of Atlanta's black colleges. Atlanta University began almost literally in a railroad car on a railroad siding in 1865, and then got money from the Freedmen's Bureau, which was established directly in result of the Civil War. And that and the
and
other
who were
black
the freedmen?
Colleges.
I'm sorry.
Just... Freed slaves, people who had been held as slaves and were now freed according to the 13th Amendment. And, you know, what do they want at this point? Well, they want what anybody wants. They want a shot at the American dream. And they know full well that the shot at the American dream, the best shot, is through education, to learn to read and write and more, right? So they want educational facilities. And the fact of these colleges beginning in Atlanta also begins this sort of, or it plays into or plays along with the growth of Atlanta as a commercial city. And you begin to, you know, certainly by the early 20th century, you have a black, educated, middle and upper class, certainly segregated from the rest of the city, but very much an elite class that you don't see very many, if any, other places right here in the South. And, of course, that's the pool of talent and skill and knowledge from which the leaders of the civil rights movement will emerge later in the 20th century.
We know a lot about these cultural benefits that took a long time and are still being worked on to, in varying degrees. But I don't know how many people realize the physical benefits of the Civil War that, you know, resulted in Atlanta's development.
Right. Well, there's nothing like a good forest fire to reinvigorate the undergrowth. And that is, in essence, what happened to Atlanta in 1864. We now estimate about 40%, that's 40% of the city was destroyed, but that was the central business district. You know, it was a lot of the important, all the infrastructure, all the industry, and all the railroads. So, I mean, it was a pretty heavy blow. But at the same time, within 18 months, so much of that had already been rebuilt, and there was so much money flowing in. And you had a lot of people coming in from the countryside who were starting over again, both blacks and whites. You had a lot of northern business people who were here. And, of course, Atlanta occupies a strategically vital place. You know, it's at the hub of the railroads. It kind of links the south of the Appalachian Mountains. So Atlanta's in a great position to have this great economic boom after the war, and to develop what we now know and what we call the Atlanta spirit, you know, which is the spirit of boosterism and advertising your business and making your city attractive, such that when Sherman comes back to Atlanta on a visit in the 1880s, there's actually an article in the newspaper thanking him for helping us to develop this wonderful city that we wouldn't have had he not burned the place down. Sure, it all depends on how you tell the story as to what is history, right? History is a bunch of stories that we tell each other to justify our past and make sense of our present, right? So if we're trying to make sense of the present, we're going to find something in the past to justify it. And the Civil War is the great American storehouse of stories. I mean, you can find anything you want in the Civil War, you bring it forward, and you can somehow make it apply to something that's going on today. When you look at history, it gives you a certain perspective, and it kind of gives you, in my opinion at least, a long view. And back up and look at where we have been in, just say, the last 50 years in our memory of the Civil War. Okay, 50 years ago, why was the Civil War important? Well, the Civil War was important 50 years ago because it reunited the country, and a reunited country was important for the United States to put on a brave and solid face in front of the threat of international communism. Right? That's one of the big reasons the Civil War was important 50 years ago. 50 years ago, the Civil Rights Movement really hadn't come to its full fruition. Now, 50 years later, why is the Civil War important? Because it was the direct antecedent of the Civil Rights Movement. It was the expansion of liberty for more and more people. Well, both things are still true, but one thing now seems truer than the other because we've looked at it in that long view.
Two horses were trotting, they pranced and they ran. Each one was commanded by a cavalry man. Two horses stood grazing where their dead riders lay. A Union mare, a Confederate gray. They nuzzled each other as they teased and had fun. They bathed in the warm rays of that old southern sun. no more senseless orders for them to obey. They acted like lovers, this mare and this gray.
You're listening to Sidewalk Radio. I'm your host, Gene Kansas. Today's show, Freedom, the City from Civil War to Civil Rights. We now bring the story of history to the voices of the present. And we have, as a very special guest today, one of Atlanta's most resolute and impassioned voices for freedom, U.S. Congressman John Lewis.
The only thing it takes to be a voice for freedom is to be prepared and be willing to speak up for the freedom of all humankind. When you see something that is not right, something not fair, not just, when you see people being mistreated or people being held down because of their class, their race, their religion, or national origin, you have a moral obligation to do something, to find a way to change things. That will always be a cause, a price to pay to be free. When I was much younger, as a teenager, I heard the words of Martin Luther King Jr. on my old radio. It seemed like he was speaking directly to me. And I wanted to do something about what I saw. When my mother and father heard that I was sitting in at lunch counters or going on a freedom ride, they thought I was going to get hurt or maybe killed. And they told me not to get in trouble. Don't get in trouble. But I got in trouble. It was good trouble. It was necessary trouble. And I think because of not just what I tried to do, but hundreds and thousands and millions of citizens, black and white, Latinos, Asian American, Native American, tried to do, our country is a better country. And we are a freer country. But we're not truly there yet. We still have work to do.
Congressman Lewis doesn't just embody the struggle for freedom. His personal legacy is also a good example of how the city is grappling with how best to represent its cultural past in its physical presence. In Freedom Park, there's actually a square named after Congressman Lewis. And in that square, there's an amazing sculpture titled The Bridge by one of the South's preeminent artists and documentarians of the African-American experience, Thornton Dial.
It means a great deal to me to have this work of art that Thornton Dial developed as a tribute to me. Mr. Dial is a very gifted folk artist growing up in Alabama, working in the steel mill, and he used the tools and the materials around him to develop a beautiful work of art. He has the ability to depict our history, our struggle. Without the art, without the painting, the sculpt pieces, the drawings, without music, dance, theater, whatever you want to call it, the civil rights movement would have been like a bird without wings. Somehow, in some way, artists were able to tell us something about the distance we've come, about our past, our present, but also about our future. It moved people in different ways, in different forms. It may move you to laugh, just to smile. It may move you to cry and shed some tears. But it could move you to stand up and make you more determined to engage in a struggle to make things better for all humankind.
You're listening to Sidewalk Radio. I'm your host, Gene Kansas. Today's show, Freedom, the City from Civil War to Civil Rights, brought to you by Perkins & Will. This question of how to transform our ideals into concrete finds its largest expression in an ambitious new museum, which will help anchor downtown and Centennial Olympic Park. It's currently under construction and is the National Center for Civil and Human Rights.
We had an architectural competition a few years ago. Phil Freelon, who's also designing the new African American History and Culture Museum for the Smithsonian in D.C., won the competition in partnership with HOK and their Atlanta office. And Phil's conception of the design was always trying to embody in some way the notion of civil and human rights, both of those concepts. And when we say civil rights, we really think about American civil rights movement. And when we say human rights, we think about the broad palette of human rights issues. His initial design was actually literally two arms that overlapped and touched one another, almost like you see in the old films of people marching in the 60s. As we evolved, we actually said, you know, from a function perspective, we don't want two long hallways, because that's in essence what you get when you get two long arms, right? You get two long hallways. We said we want something that's a bit more subtle that we can actually do more with internally. So his conception that we're going to build is actually two hands that embody a relatively oval space. And that's interesting for two reasons. One, most civil and human rights movements happen in a square, in a park, in the city center where people gather. And so it creates almost this notion of people gathering to do work around civil and human rights. The other is, because of that shape, you actually can choose how you experience our major galleries in the order you want to experience them. So you can start with the King Papers, and then you can go to Civil Rights, and then you can go to Human Rights. Or you can start with Human Rights, and then you can go to King Papers, and then you can go to Civil Rights. You can pick and choose the way that you think about these issues. So we wanted the architecture to be able to embody that notion of choosing, but also that notion of civil and human rights coming together. And so these two powerful walls form the two hands to do that.
Applying that to Atlanta for a moment and our Atlanta identity, we haven't had something that I would consider a visual identity. But this physical center and what's going on around Centennial Park has a promise for that.
I think Atlanta is still answering the question, who are we? What do we want to be? I think the legacy of the civil rights movement is probably the most viable signature issue to tap into, to use to redefine ourselves. And so I think the center and everything that's happened around Centennial Park can be basically the manifestation of, this is what Atlanta is, so that when people bring their nephews and bring their uncles, they say, this is who we are. And not only that, but when they solve problems, they say, this is how we solve them. Civil rights movement in Atlanta was basically a story of compromise, nonviolent compromise. When things needed to be done, desegregation of schools, desegregation of counters, desegregation of business, it was a compromise of equals. African-American community, Jewish community, white political community, business community came together and figured it out. Birmingham was about violence.
Yeah.
It's a struggle.
Why was Atlanta different?
Andy Young once told me, he said, you can never underestimate the fact that African-Americans in Atlanta had been earning degrees for generations, had been building businesses for generations, had been doctors, lawyers, teachers for generations. So when it came time to the civil rights movement in Atlanta, one, we had relationships that ran generations with the power structure. And two, we were respected. We knew how to do things. We came to the table as equals. And so that changed the dynamic, because even though it may not have been that every business wanted to desegregate, they were looking across the table at a businessman or a businesswoman who was African-American, but who knew exactly what they were struggling with. And he said, one, that changed the way we solved those issues. And two, when African-Americans came, desegregation happened, and African-Americans came into the civic space, you immediately saw Maynard Jackson elected mayor, Andy elected to Congress, Jesse Hill take over the MARTA board, and eventually the Chamber of Commerce. And what Andy said, which is right, is a lot changed and nothing changed. In essence, business continued. Atlanta continued to grow. The airport continued to expand because everyone had been at the table and had shared that common vision. And I think that is so different than any other place in the South, where the white power community didn't fundamentally respect the African-American community, didn't fundamentally know them, didn't fundamentally believe they knew the struggles that they were facing, whereas here, it was much more of a table of equals.
And did that legacy help in large part to get this center done?
Absolutely. No question about it. It helped to get the center done. It helped to allow the center to be human rights focused, because so many folks said, yes, that's what we were actually working for, was for human rights for all, not just specific freedom for African Americans. And it also allowed a 30-something guy to be picked by the mayor of Atlanta, who was the first African American female to lead a major city, to do this. I think all of those things come together Atlanta is very comfortable, back to the previous conversation, Atlanta is very comfortable with the nuances around these issues, where other cities are only comfortable with the headlines around these issues.
Not too far down the road from the Civil and Human Rights Museum is another museum, also constructed on the fault lines of race, but with a very different historical resonance. In southwest Atlanta, in a now historically black neighborhood, is the Wren's Nest, the former home of author Joel Chandler Harris, a white man who grew up among slaves and popularized their stories to a white audience the world over. And while his work brought exposure, recognition, and acceptance to African-American culture, it also created and institutionalized stereotypes and prejudices that have continued as long as the stories have been told, which is up to today. It's a complicated legacy and perhaps an even more difficult project of historic preservation.
What Harris tried to do over his career was introduce a white Southern reading audience into accepting and relishing in this African-American culture and folklore that had either been derided or had been too scary or just been totally ignored. These stories are so diverse. I mean, they've been told to children before, but what Harris does is he puts the reader in the seat of a little white boy learning about this culture for the very first time. And these parents are reading these stories to their kids, the kids are eating it up, and they think it's hilarious. But what Harris is really sneaking in is ideas like the stories in the Bible may not be true. When civilization started, everyone used to be black. Ideas about miscegenation, really, really radical stuff, especially for the 19th century, and all under the guise of children's literature.
Uncle Remus, tell us a story.
Uncle Remus said,
gather round me, little children, before you go to bed. Just give me your attention, hear what I've got to say. I'll tell you how the animals got that way.
What Uncle Remus said.
The leopard's pappy got the gout from eating too much speckled trout. His mammy dreamed of polka dots. That's how the leopard got his spots.
That's what Uncle Remus said. That's what Uncle Remus said.
From speckled trout and polka dots.
That's how the leopard got his spots.
More, tell us more.
They threw the fox into.
These stories are rooted in the South. They're rooted in, Harris roots them in Georgia specifically. Uncle Remus is from Middle Georgia. He's got storytellers from the coast with a totally different dialect. Storytellers from North Georgia, totally different dialect. And then kind of city folks that go through in and out of the stories. So they're firmly rooted in the South. But they're written in Atlanta, and they started at the Atlanta Constitution, and they were written as a serial, you know, for people in the paper to read. It was like the funny papers before then, but it was very much grounded in this very specific time, very specific place. And by introducing readers here to, you know, a mirror of themselves, and that becoming so popular, it introduced international audience to the very same thing. They got to see Atlanta for the first time. They got to see what a Southern accent was for the first time. And I think that's really powerful just after the Civil War that somebody in Germany could be reading and relishing in African-American folklore that is very much an Atlanta thing. Kind of a first step in sharing the African-American voice and culture with most of the world.
And we're talking like over 140 years ago, right?
Yeah, he was born in 1845, worked in Savannah during the 1870s, and in 1876, Henry Grady kind of poached him away and hired him at the Atlanta Constitution. He worked there for the next, 25 years in charge of the editorial page and was very prolific. Harris was short, stuttering, stammering, freckled, redheaded. He was illegitimate. His mother was very poor. He had a hard life to begin with. Harris grew up in a little shack behind the doctor who birthed him. He had a house, and so he grew up kind of behind there. Well, his mom was a seamstress and then also helped her neighbor's garden to make loose ends meet. Harris then, during the Civil War, he was a teenager, and he went to go, instead of fighting in the Civil War, he went to work on a plantation to help support his mom.
So he was actually working on the plantation. Is that where he started hearing these tales?
Yeah, he was an apprentice on the plantation. The guy who owned the place was a really eccentric intellectual, and he had a newspaper that went out to about 2,000 homes across the Confederacy. And so Harris worked for room, board, clothing, food. And yeah, that's where he learned both the printer's trade. That's where he learned to read all the classics in this guy's library. And that's where he learned the Brer Rabbit stories from the folks around him on the plantation.
He's hearing these stories. Where do these stories come from?
Many of them are centuries old and have crossed oceans from Western Africa. There's really, it's hard to say when a story starts and when a story stops, unless somebody like Joel Chandler Harris comes and puts his imprint on it in 1880 or 1882, and then you've got that version. But other versions keep going, and other versions had existed long before. So these stories originated in Western Africa, and as the circumstances of the tellers changed, the stories themselves changed.
So going back to your personal story, you're asked to come on board and you have some reservations.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I was pretty much fresh out of college, working at a hardware store before I came to the Wren's Nest, and to direct this, you know, century-old house museum founded with money from Andrew Carnegie and Teddy Roosevelt. That was a tall order, especially for something that I didn't know very much about, that I had just heard and assumed was very controversial at best and bad at worst. And coming to Southwest Atlanta, which is for the past 50 years or so has been an African-American neighborhood, taking over this controversial landmark in there as a 23-year-old white guy, that's a daunting task. So it was a weird start.
How so?
I mean, my first day, the Georgia Power man came to shut off the lights, and I had been working at a minimum wage job beforehand, and I had more money in my bank account than the Wren's Nest had, the supposedly esteemed and aged institution. So we had very humble beginnings, at least in 2006 when I got started. Luckily, we after a year or so, we kind of convinced folks that I wasn't just kind of playing around and having a little playhouse National Historic Landmark, but we were serious about restoring this place and restoring not only the legacy of the Brer Rabbit stories, but really the physical location as well.
Why is it important to restore the physical location?
I mean, it's part of the patina of Atlanta. It's part of our history, and it's where we came from. And so much of Atlanta is torn down and forgotten that we're very lucky to have a National Historic Landmark of international importance that is both historically important, but really, I don't know, it's an anchor for the Southwest Atlanta, an anchor for West End. It's important then, it's important now, and it's going to be important 100 years from now.
I'd like to thank my guests today, Gordon Jones, Congressman John Lewis, Doug Shipman, and Lane Shakespeare. Of course, I'd also like to thank our sponsor, international architecture and design firm Perkins & Will. You've been listening to Sidewalk Radio. Please check us out on iTunes, where you can enjoy previous episodes, and, if you will, please rate and review us. I'm your host, Gene Kansas. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next month. Today's show is dedicated to Uncle Bud, born Winston Blodgett Newell in the year 1924 in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Bud served our country in World War II, embodied independent thinking. He was a lover of jazz, made a great James Bond martini, and was a gentle and loving husband, father, friend, and uncle. He'll be greatly missed, but his spirit lives on.